Good afternoon and welcome to this month's meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Erickson Hall at Point Lookout in Northport, Maine. And a particular welcome to our public radio audience. I'm Tom DeMarco, filling in for Mac DeFord, president of the Forum. Since 1985, the Forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited speaker from the world of foreign service, journalism, or academia talk about the critical foreign policy issues facing the U.S. and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. The Midcoast Forum is honored today to present Dr. Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Dr. Landis writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter on Syrian politics. As a member of the Forum Board, I've been reading, along with the other directors, Syria Comment recently, and I can tell you it is fascinating stuff. You can't be an expert on Syria, as Josh is, without also being an expert on the entire Middle East. Take a look at syriacomment.com for an astonishingly frank and refreshing take on Middle East politics today. You can see Josh's academic credentials on our website. I'll tell you instead something of his personal history. He was brought up in the Middle East, in Lebanon and Saudi Arabia, returned after college as a teacher to Lebanon, and was subsequently sent as the very first Fulbright scholar to Damascus University in Syria. Married to a Syrian Alawite woman, Josh speaks and reads and writes Arabic. Welcome, Joshua Landis.
Thank you so much. Let me talk today about Syria and the region, and U.S.-Syrian relations, which have been, which are not good, needless to say, and under President Obama remain quite bad. The engagement with Syria and the Islamic world in general that President Obama promised when he first came to office has not materialized. In this talk, I'll explain why promoting peace between Israel and Syria is important for the U.S. If it hopes to preserve its broad interests in the Middle East and good relations with Arab allies such as Egypt and Tunisia, the democratic revolution now spreading across the Arab world is fraught with opportunity and danger for the U.S. If the U.S. does not solve the Arab-Israeli conflict, it will increasingly be forced to choose between friendship with Israel and its longtime allies in the region. Turkey, in many ways, is a bellwether for this trend. As it has grown more democratic, it has begun to criticize American policies that the Turkish public feels strongly about. Chief among these are continuing dispossession of Palestinians and expansion of Israeli settlement in East Jerusalem and the occupied territories. We have already seen how the blockade of Gaza and the Mavi Morav incident has damaged relations between the U.S. and Turkey, which has all but broken its historic ties to Israel. Washington legislators seem determined to punish Ankara for its disloyalty and impertinence rather than to pressure Israel, Syria, and the Palestinians to make peace. Congress has refused to confirm a U.S. ambassador to Turkey, forcing President Obama to go around it and make a term appointment, just as he did in appointing an ambassador to Syria. America's bad relations with Iran are also intimately connected to the Arab-Israeli conflict. In short, democracy will undermine U.S. relations with Middle Eastern governments unless people believe that the U.S. is acting as an even-handed proponent of peace and an enforcer of international law. Peace between Israel and Syria is the easiest first step in a more comprehensive rearrangement of the Middle East. A solution for the Golan issue in the Golan Heights, which are occupied by Israel, has largely been worked out in negotiations between President Clinton and Prime Minister Barak in the 1990s. Both Syrian and Israeli military leaders argue that a peace deal based on the return to 1967 borders would be good for both countries and is doable. So why have Syrian-U.S. relations gone nowhere? And why will they likely remain bad? I will argue that the regional balance of power has been too skewed in favor of Israel to make a deal look advantageous to Israeli governments and into Americans. Will Syria give up claims to Golan? Can it change the balance of power? Will there be another war between Israel and Hezbollah that may involve Syria? Is Syria important to the U.S.? These are some of the questions I hope to touch on in this talk. The WikiLeaks cables have unveiled a treasure trove of diplomatic correspondence that refines our understanding of the U.S.-Syrian relationship. They explain why engagement has failed and where the stumbling blocks are. Now, before rehearsing a few of these WikiLeaks cables for you, let me give a bit of historical background to make the argument that the U.S.-Syrian relations are contingent on Israel, and that the Golan issue is, in fact, Syria's issue, as President Assad has recently insisted, and not just an excuse to remain at war, as some have argued. U.S.-Syrian relations have been bad since President Truman decided to back the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine in 1947. U.S. representatives, at the end of World War II, gathered together to try to hammer out what U.S. policy towards the Middle East should be at the end of the war. The Middle East had had almost no policy towards the Middle East in the interwar period. It had very few interests in the Middle East. This was before the days of Saudi oil and so forth. And in 45, the U.S. representatives sat down. They decided the U.S. should concentrate on relations with Saudi Arabia, where the oil was, and Syria, where oil pipelines were going to bring Saudi oil out through Syria and then to Tripoli in northern Lebanon. Anglo-Iraqi oil was being brought out across the Syrian desert to Tartus in the coast there. So Syria was an important transit country. It had a balanced entrepreneurial class. It had agriculture and so forth. It was a viable state. And the French had also been kicked out in 1946. Syria was independent, and the Americans thought, this is fertile territory. We can make something of Syria. And the Syrian president at the time, Shukri al-Kawatli, an upper-class, Turkish-educated, Ottoman-educated landowner, looked towards America as a way to an alliance with America, as a way to bolster himself in this world that had been run by France and Britain in the Middle East. And he also had inherited from the French an army that was jammed with minorities, Syrian minorities, Alawites, Druze, Ismailis, Sunnis from the countryside, Armenians, Christians. He didn't trust them. He believed they were ghair watani, as he called them, not nationalist enough, because they would not be loyal to the Sunni landholders who ran Syria. And he wanted an American military mission to come, a bunch of officers to come and train his army. And under the cover of this mission and new equipment, he would be able to change the composition of the Syrian army, he believed. So he began asking America for this training mission and to become sort of a benefactor of Syria. By 1947, we get a letter from Secretary of State Marshall saying, tell the Syrians that this is not going to happen, because there's going to be war in Palestine between the Jews and the Arabs. And Congress and American here in America, we can't give arms or training to Syria. Tell them to go to Sweden, he said, and ask for help. Almost within days, you can see there are Syrian memoirs from the defense minister and so forth who show that once they got word that America was not going to help them, they immediately started arguing, we've got to go to the Soviet Union. Who are we going to get arms for? There's going to be a war in Palestine. And you begin to see the pressure to go to the Soviet Union because America has cut Syria off. And this is the beginning, of course, of Syrian alienation from America. And Syrian relations are going to go from bad to worse. By the end of the 1948 war, there are almost 300,000 Palestinian refugees. The Syrian army, the Syrian little military effort in Palestine, Syria sent about 3,000 soldiers into Palestine, but they get beaten up fairly badly. Syria grabs a teeny bit of land across the border in Palestine, but it doesn't play a big role. But it's been badly bruised. The political leadership has been discredited in Syria, and by the end of the war, there's a coup. the chief of staff, who's been blamed for the failure of the war effort, Hosni Zaim, takes over. But he takes over with the help of the CIA. Miles Copeland, young guy there, supports this this coup d'etat, and because Hosni Zaim, the military chief, offers four things. He promises that he will help settle the Palestinian refugees in Syria and make them Syrians, thereby bringing an end to the Palestinian problem. An American, this would get rid of the Palestinian refugees from Jordan and other places. He would make peace with Israel. He would arrest a whole bunch of communists that America had listed, and he was going to open up the oil pipelines from Saudi Arabia through Syria to Lebanon that had been closed during the hostilities where there hadn't been progress in laying the last pipe. And the Syrian parliament was anti-American. They weren't going to allow this to happen. So in many ways, America helped to undermine a fledgling democracy that had been left by the French. It undermined the Sunni upper class elite. And it put the army in charge of Syria, helped. This was being done for domestic Syrian reasons as well. But America went along. And this is the beginning of what we have today in Syria, which is an Alawite-led government in Syria, because the Alawites were the dominant minority within the Syrian army. And the Sunnis were thrown out by the end of the 50s. The rise of Nasserism and so forth pushed aside the Sunnis, who had constantly tried to go to America, didn't get satisfaction, and the socialist parties, the Ba'ath Party, were saying, we've got to go to Russia. And they won the name, they won this debate, because Russia was the only country that was willing to help Syria build up its army and to support Syria. So the leftists won, and the rural country people won, and they threw out the upper Sunni class that would have been sympathetic to the West, capitalism, and so forth, had been trained mostly in the West. And that led to a whole new chapter in Syrian history in the 1960s when the Ba'ath Party took over, looked to the Soviet Union, and Syria became a staunch enemy of the United States. This led, at the height of Arab nationalism with Nasser, to the 67 war, when Israel conquered the Golan Heights, the big plateau that separates Israel from Syria, and has occupied that region ever since. About well over 100,000 Golanis fled during the invasion, and are refugees today. There are about 300 and some odd thousand Golanis living in Syria who are refugees in a lobby group for getting back the Golan. And there are about 20,000 Israeli settlers in the Golan Heights today, which make it very difficult to solve because it's an important section of the Israeli population. But this sets the stage for Syria's foreign policy, which is oriented around the problem of getting back this big hunk of territory, this irredentist cause, the Golan Heights. If you look at Syria's foreign policy, its friends, its enemies, it's all about the Golan. Syria is friends with Iran, because Iran would help arm it. It was friends with Russia, because Russia would arm it. It's friends with Hezbollah, the PLO. It was friends with the Palestinian resistance. It's friends with Hamas. All of these are countries that are willing to arm it or help it in its struggle with Israel, in an attempt to pressure Israel to give back the Golan. Israel, of course, was very weak once the Soviet Union collapsed, and it tried to develop allies, as many allies as it could, to counterbalance the power of Israel. And that meant non-state actors like Hezbollah, which it nurtured in southern Lebanon, which Iran also nurtured, and which was the most effective anti-Israeli tool, really, in the Syrian toolkit. But also Hamas, Palestinians. Who are the enemies of Syria in the Arab world? America's allies. Egypt, which signed Camp David, and the Camp David was a big blow to Syria because it meant that no Arab combination would ever be able to go to war again against Israel, as long as the Egyptian army was out. That's why as soon as the Egyptian revolution broke out, the Intifada in Tahrir Square, the banner headlines across Syrian TV were the end of the Camp David regime. And that just scrolled constantly underneath the Syrian headlines because for Syria, that was the importance of the Egyptian. It was, we're going to get rid of this Israeli-Egyptian alliance and America's ability to, Israel's ability to keep the Golan Heights. That's what they're thinking. You know, Israel gets weaker, Syria gets stronger, maybe they'll get back to Golan. That's the way Syrians thought about it. Saudi Arabia has also had bad relations with Syria because it's part of this Israeli-Egyptian-Saudi alliance supports the United States policy against Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, so forth. So that's the political framework. Those are the alliance systems. And Syria is very keen on supporting Iran, getting the support of Iran and others in the hopes of getting back the Golan Heights. Okay, the Golan issue is Syria's issue. President Bashar al-Assad explained in a January 2010 confidential dispatch that we have from WikiLeaks. He said, the Golan is our issue. He was speaking to a visiting delegation of American congressmen. And he says this periodically in most of these cables. You go through them. He described Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic organization, as an uninvited guest in Damascus and suggested that he would be willing to give up the alliance if Syria could sign a peace with Israel that would return the whole of the Golan Heights. Assad promised U.S. officials that Syria was ready to change its relationship to Hamas and Hezbollah if it gets back the Golan. Syria is designated by the United States as a terrorist-supporting country and there are sanctions and so forth because it supports Hezbollah and Hamas, which it sees as national liberation organizations that are fighting to get back land that's been occupied by Israel and are allies of Syria in its attempt to get back the Golan Heights, which is occupied by Israel. So Syria says these are not terrorist organizations. America says yes, they are, and has imposed sanctions. So we can see also in a recent Wall Street Journal interview, just given several weeks ago, where the Wall Street Journal said, on Lebanon, I'm sure you've heard from John Kerry and others about Syria's military link with Hezbollah. And it's trying to prod Assad on Hezbollah and saying, why do you support Hezbollah? You're supporting terrorists. And Assad said, let me go back to the problem with the United States. In the United States, they always talk about subtitles, about chapters in a book, without looking at the main title of the book. Now, what's that title? He's saying it's peace. We cannot follow a cherry-picking approach. Once we talk about Hezbollah, once we talk about Hamas, once we talk about armaments and smuggling of arms to Hamas and Hezbollah, the question is, why do we have these issues? Because of the lack of peace, he said. As long as you do not have peace, you will have everything that you do not like. So he was trying to reinforce this issue that it's the Golan, stupid. I mean, that's what he was saying. Now, the basic problem in U.S.-Syrian relations is laid out clearly and simply in this exchange. The Wall Street Journal interviewer asked President Assad about Syrian support for Hezbollah, which the U.S. defines as a terrorist organization. Syria will always arm Hezbollah and Hamas, which it defines as legitimate national liberation organizations, so long as Israel continues to occupy the Syrian land. Every discussion with U.S. officials comes back to this Golan and peace question. Let us look at just two WikiLeaks cables on this issue. The first is a cable dated February 2009, a little over a year ago. It records the conversation between a congressional delegation led by Senator Cardin, a Democrat from Maryland, and President Assad. They discuss Iran, the peace process, terrorism, human rights in Syria, a whole host of issues. And then they get to Hezbollah. Now, the cable says, Assad argued Hezbollah has no specific interest in Israel besides securing Lebanon's borders and preventing threats to Lebanon's integrity. Like Israel's daily violations of Lebanese airspace, he said, Assad noted Hezbollah was the most powerful political party in Lebanon, was democratically elected. If But he said if peace in the region were to be achieved, the small things with Hezbollah and Hamas would disappear, he said. Now, we can question whether that's true or not true, but this is the argument he's making. We won't support them. There can be peace between Hezbollah and Israel if the borders are arranged. Let's talk about peace, he said. This is the big picture that will solve everything. Assad likened the U.S.'s approach to Hezbollah to trying to patch an old suit when what was really needed was to buy a new suit. Senator Cardin countered that peace would very likely go forward if Syria would first stop the arms flow to Hezbollah and Hamas. Now, here in a nutshell is the problem that we always come back to. Assad, in effect, says the Golan is the issue. Get us peace and get us the Golan, and we will change our relationship to Hezbollah and Hamas. The U.S. responds that Syria's support for terrorism is the problem. You cut relations with Hezbollah and Hamas, and we can push Israel to try to give back the Golan and get this peace issue back on the table. But you have to stop supporting terrorism. If you do that, we can't move ahead. Now, there is a profound amount of mistrust between both of these sides. The U.S. officials, such as Cardin, insist that Assad cannot be trusted, but just as importantly, it is politically unfeasible for a U.S. official to pressure Israel while Syria arms its enemies. The conflict is a domestic issue, and both the Democratic and Republican parties vie for the title as the most pro-Israeli party. They're not going to go out and do a lot of good things for Syria if Syria is still hurting Israel. When Senator Cardin's delegation spoke to Israel's prime minister about peace with Syria, Netanyahu told the U.S. lawmakers that giving up the Golan would only result in assurances that Syria would later tear up. He said, we can't trust Syria. We're not going to move ahead with this. If we look at it from the Syrian point of view, however, President Assad is convinced that that Israel is willing to give up the Golan, and that the U.S. is incapable of pressuring, that Israel is unwilling to give up the Golan, and that the U.S. is incapable of pressuring Israel to do so. Syrian officials point to the way Prime Minister Netanyahu has repeatedly outmaneuvered President Obama's attempts to get the Palestinian peace talks off the ground or to pressure Israel to stop building settlements. And they say, look, they can't make any headway with Israel on the settlements. How are they going to get us back to Golan if we cut off support for Hamas and Hezbollah? They'll laugh all the way to the bank. That'll be the end of us. We'll have no alliance system. We'll have nowhere to pressure Israel, and we won't have the Golan. So they don't see this as genuine. They see this as, and this is where we get stuck. Thus, the Syrians believe the issue is all about the balance of power. When Syria is strong, Israel will deal with it. So long as it is weak and its allies are weak, as they are today, Israel will ignore Syria. Syria sees the U.S. as the key to the balance of power. It believes that the U.S. guarantees Israel's military hegemony in the region through its diplomatic, economic, and military support. It should be remembered that the U.S. government in 2007 officially guaranteed Israel's qualitative military edge, or QME, as it's called. The QME is defined as a guarantee to ensure, this is the official language, Israel's ability to counter and defeat any military threat from any state, coalition of states, or non-state actors, while itself sustaining minimal casualties or damage. U.S. economic sanctions on Israel, on Syria, its effort to isolate Syria financially and commercially, and its work to shut down the flow of arms and weapons to Syria and its allies, are all viewed by Damascus as part of Washington's policy of tilting the scales to Israel's favor. Efforts to push Syrian influence out of Lebanon and to bring Iran to its knees by strangling it economically are equally viewed by Damascus as preserving Israel's military supremacy over the region. Cables from Damascus to Washington routinely insist that Assad wants peace. One from April 2009 reads, President Assad's rhetoric and his private remarks suggest he attaches a high value to U.S. involvement in peace talks with Israel, the cable reads. We believe, the representative in Damascus writes, we believe that signaling U.S. openness to promoting a peace deal between Israel and Syria will undercut Syrian justifications for fomenting violence in the name of resistance to Israeli occupation. Now, this indicates, the language used here indicates the pressure on Washington to get some process going, regardless of whether it will ever actually bring peace or not. The representative in Damascus is saying, well, at least let's pretend we're going to bring peace, and that will cut down, it'll make Syria behave better. And that is, in a sense, where America has been to a certain extent, is trying to promote the process, whether there's going to be peace at the end or not, in order to have a process so that things don't go bad. Ambassador Indyk at Brookings Institute recently said, you know, it's like, peace process is like riding a bicycle. As long as you're going forward, you stay upright. As soon as you stop the peace process, you fall over and bad things start to happen because you can't convince people that you're trying to solve the problem. So there's significant pressure on Washington to get the process going, regardless of whether it will bring peace. Israel and Washington often accuse Syria of wanting the process, but not the peace. It is more likely that Washington wants the process because it will keep the lid on hostilities, even if there is no prospect for peace. Another more recent and telling cable is between Ali Mamlouk and Daniel Benjamin. This is February 2010. Daniel Benjamin is the U.S. coordinator for counterterrorism. Ali Mamlouk is the head of the Syrian intelligence. Syria's Deputy Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad was also at the meeting. And this is a nuts and bolts cable. Both Syria and America understand that they cannot go straight to peace talks, so they are searching for some acceptable middle ground or plan B. They need to build a relationship from the small things. Syrians keep insisting that the U.S. and Syria have overlapping interests in 80% of their policies. The first place Syrians and Americans are hoping to engage was on al-Qaeda, intelligence sharing over Islamic extremists and infiltrators into Iraq. This is why Benjamin was in Damascus and why Assad asked Ali Mamlouk, the head of intelligence, to pay a special surprise visit to the meeting and to sit down and talk brass tacks, the intelligence guys. Here is the important quote from the cable. Miqdad, foreign ministry, says that convincing the Syrian people to support cooperation with the U.S. would hinge on progress on economic sanctions against Syria and Syria being taken off the lists. And by this, he means the lists of countries that support terrorism, which inhibits foreign investment in Syria, tourism, and so forth by being designated a terrorist state. So, but these are all put on Syria because Syria is fighting Israel for supporting Hezbollah and Hamas. So in a sense, he's asking that America close its eyes to the Arab-Israeli conflict and to what Syria is doing with Hezbollah. Benjamin said that Obama administration viewed counterterrorism as a vital concern, but unlike its predecessor, it did not see counterterrorism as something that was separate from the rest of U.S. foreign policy or the sole driver of U.S. foreign policy. In short, Miqdad and Mamlouk tell Benjamin that Syria would like to set aside the Arab-Israeli conflict. Washington should close its eyes to Syria's ongoing struggle for the Golan, which necessitates arming Hezbollah, in order to cooperate on destroying the real terror networks, al-Qaeda, and securing the Iraq border. Syria claims that it has infiltrated. In the same cable, Syria goes on saying we've infiltrated a number of al-Qaeda networks, that it can help America save lives. It's trying to fluff up its capabilities and say, you know, this is a good trade for you. We'll give you help on al-Qaeda, Iraq, other things you want. You close your eyes to the Arab-Israeli conflict, take us off the sanctioned list, and we'll have a basis for better relations. Benjamin says, no, can do. Israel is more important to us, in essence, than these other issues. You have to stop supporting Hezbollah before we can move ahead with cooperation on al-Qaeda or Iraq or other things like this. Now, a number of Syrian officials over the past few years have insisted on the same point to me. They say, why can't the U.S. be more neutral? We know the U.S. will never be against Israel, but at the very least, it should not take sides. Since President Obama came to office, this issue is where U.S.-Syrian relations continue to get stuck. Benjamin explained to the Syrians that the U.S. would not separate its counterterrorism policy, i.e. its search for al-Qaeda, from its Israel policy. The U.S. insists on Syria ending its support for resistance to Israeli occupation of the Golan before normalization of relations can move forward. Syria insists the U.S. help Syria get back the Golan first before Syria will cooperate on the other issues, such as al-Qaeda, Lebanon, Hamas, terrorism. And if the U.S. cannot get back the Golan for Syria, then it must change its policy towards Israel. It must take a more neutral stand and close its eyes to Syria's support for Hezbollah and Hamas. This would allow Washington to move forward with normalizing relations with Syria, lifting economic sanctions, cooperating on the host of regional issues. Okay. But all efforts to get past this impasse have failed. And it's constantly the same conversation happening over and over, and nothing good has come of it. That is why the Senate will not confirm a Syrian ambassador. It is why Syria refuses to move forward on intelligence sharing, and why relations remain in the dumps. So what do the Israelis say about this? Let's look at a cable between Secretary of Defense Virchow, who meets with the senior Israeli defense officials. Included among these officials is the head of Defense Intelligence Analysis, Brigadier General Yossi Baidatz. And a summary, the summary of the cable reads, "The Israelis expressed positive views on continued U.S. cooperation, particularly on Israel's qualitative military edge, the QME, and on ongoing Juniper Cobra missile defense exercises." America's just financed a new missile defense regime for Israel so that if Hezbollah shoots rockets, they will be able to shoot them down. Israeli officials explained that they were going through an unprecedented period of calm due to the deterrent effect of Operation Cast Lead. That's with Gaza. But that below the surface were a number of significant challenges. Israeli officials were concerned about the deteriorating Turkey-Israel relationship and discussed threats emanating from Syria and Lebanon. But he was very optimistic about Syria. Baidatz offered an Israeli intelligence assessment that if Syria were able to achieve peace with security and obtain greater U.S. involvement, it may pull away from Iran's orbit. That's Syria, if there was peace with Syria. He explained that President Assad used his negative assets, namely Hezbollah and Hamas, to make himself relevant, and that ultimately Assad wants it all. The Golan Heights, peace with Israel, better relations with the U.S., a strong relationship with Iran. Ultimately, General Baidatz asserted that if Assad had to choose one thing, it would likely be peace with Israel. Israeli Chief of Staff General Gavi Ashkenazi told a U.S. congressional delegation in November 2009, which is recorded in a Norwegian paper, and it goes, the memo on the talks between Ashkenazi and Congressman Ike Skelton, as well as numerous other documents from the same period of time, which the often posted has gained access to, leave a clear message. The Israeli military is forging ahead at full speed with preparations for a new war in the Middle East. The paper says that's because of Hezbollah and 2006. The paper says that the U.S. cables, quote Ashkenazi, telling the U.S. congressman, "I am preparing the Israeli army for a major war, since it is easier to scale down to a smaller operation than to do the opposite and scale up. The general's plans are driven by fear of growing stockpiles of rockets in Hamas-controlled Gaza and in Hezbollah-controlled southern Lebanon. The war will be a total war on civilians," Ashkenazi explained. "In the next war, Israel cannot accept any restrictions on warfare in urban areas." Chief of Staff Ashkenazi is leaving office, or left office, this February after 4 years heading the IDF. In a long report by the Israeli Haaretz newspaper, he said that he will go charging after the next objective, which is peace with Syria. He said he wants to rescue Israel from the diplomatic status quo and prevent a dangerous war with Iran. A peace agreement with Syrian President Bashar Assad, he said, which would remove Syria from the Iranian circle of influence and weaken Hezbollah, seems the most effective way to improve Israel's strategic situation. Ashkenazi fears for the country's future should Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu continue his policy of marching in place, he said. Ashkenazi said he was troubled by the ring of threats facing Israel and the growing strength of Iran and its allies, Syria, Hezbollah, Hamas. He shares the assessments of the outgoing head of military intelligence, Amos Yadlin, that the next war will be waged in Tel Aviv and that the home front will be hit by rockets and missiles. The solution, Ashkenazi said, is peace with Syria. The price of this deal is known: withdrawal from the Golan Heights in return for security arrangements, normalized relationships. That's what he says in his cable. Now, Ilan Mizrahi, deputy chief of Mossad, says something very similar. He goes, on my first day as National Security Council to Ehud Olmert, I recommend that he make deal with Syria. It will change the security situation in the Middle East. I do not believe that his father and he himself already decided. I do believe that he has decided that he would like an agreement with Israel on giving back the Golan, he said. The best is Israeli generals are all saying, we can negotiate it. So I believe them, he said. So what is the Syrian plan? That's my last cable. But I've inundated you a little bit with these cables because they reiterate the same story over and over again. So what is Syria's plan? The trouble is that giving back the Golan Heights is politically almost impossible for Israel's leaders today. There are over 20,000 settlers, and many people believe that Netanyahu doesn't want to pull out of the Golan, and Syria is extremely weak. What's in it for Israel? Many ask. So what is Syria's plan? Why doesn't it just give up its claim to the Golan? Can it change the balance of power in its favor? Those are the big questions that everybody is constantly asking. Let's look for a second at Hezbollah's plans. Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, recently called upon his fighters just a few days ago to be ready to invade the Galilee in case Israel wages war against Lebanon. That's northern Israel. This threat bolsters Nasrallah's previous carefully phrased warnings of what Israel can expect from Hezbollah in the next war. They include a vow in February 2010 to rocket Tel Aviv's Ben-Gurion airport if Israel bombs Beirut's airport, and a declaration by Nasrallah 3 months later that Hezbollah can and will attack shipping along Israel's entire coastline if the Israeli Navy shells Lebanese. Now, with this vow to send fighters into the Galilee of Israel if Israel invades Lebanon, Nasrallah is announcing that Israel can no longer take for granted a long-established doctrine of fighting wars solely on the soil of its neighbors. Syria believes that it can increasingly build up Hezbollah with better missile technology, build itself up with these low-grade missiles that will pepper Israel, and that this is a way to change the balance of power in Syria's favor. So in a sense, Syria is trying to arm itself not only as a deterrent to Israeli incursions, but also as a way to pressure Israel to eventually come back to the table, the bargaining table, and give back the Golan Heights. Syria was very optimistic after the 2006 war in Lebanon, southern Lebanon with Hezbollah, when Israel bombed but did not destroy Hezbollah. And they thought this would be something comparable to President Sadat's 73 crossing of the Suez, that it would gain Israel's respect and make Israel sit down and negotiate with Syria. It didn't happen that way. Israel put out a few feelers, talked to Syria through Turkey for a little while, but ultimately I think Israel came to the conclusion that Hezbollah had been seriously chastened in 2006 and that Israel could ramp up, prepare for the next war, and smash Hezbollah successfully in the future. Syria is convinced that it's on a winning trajectory, not in the short term, but perhaps in the long term. And it looks towards what it calls the Northern Alliance to back itself up. This is increasing its allies beyond Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas. Syria puts great stock in improving relations with Turkey in particular. And what it hopes is an emerging Northern Alliance linking Iran, Turkey, Iraq, and Lebanon in a trade and increasingly military alliance that can pressure Israel for the Golan Heights. The democracy revolution offers Syria much new hope. The regimes which have been upended are all U.S. allies. Egypt, Tunisia, now troubles in Bahrain. The banner headlines on Syrian TV, as I said before, were "End the Camp David regime." Syria has taken much gratification from these recent events. Of course, that's if Syria regime doesn't run into troubles, and so far it's been pretty stable. Al-Baradei, one of the two major candidates for the Egyptian presidential election, has spoken about how relations between Egypt and Israel were master-to-slave relations in the past, and he would change them. All of the Egyptian candidates that are now beginning to merge are talking about having to change. They don't want to undo the Camp David Accords, but they're going to change the nature of relations and the way that Gazans have been treated and so forth. All of this is music to Syria's ears. Proof that Israel is nervous is the statement by Israel's defense minister on March 7th that Israel would be asking Washington for $20 billion more of additional U.S. military aid to counter its deteriorating security environment. That'll be, I suppose, in some ways a test for the United States, whether it's going to increasingly double down on Israeli security or whether it's going to work for a peace arrangement, which is the way, I think, out of this escalating military buildup and this dangerous situation for the United States in the region, where democracy should be playing into our hands, but may not in the short term. And in conclusion, I'd just like to say that I don't see a war breaking out anytime soon. I think Hezbollah is quite weak and chastened, the way Israel says. Israel will, of course, hang tight, hoping that Damascus suffers what Egypt and Tunisia have suffered, or perhaps even Libya, that the regime would fall in this wave of democracy revolutions. That doesn't look likely, but of course it's something that could always happen because Syria is an authoritarian regime. Israel looks at the Syrian economy, which is weak, and the Syrian people who are poor. 32% of Syrians live under the poverty line. Egypt, it was 40. But the same pressures are there on Syria that were there on Egypt and Tunisia. Syria looks, you know, from an Israeli point of view, you could look at Syria and say, well, they don't have a bright future. They're not going to be able to pressure us. This Northern Alliance isn't going to happen. The Arabs are in a mess. This democracy revolution is not going to lead to a brighter day for the Arab world in the short term. They're going to be very troubled. And I think, you know, the impetus is going to be to go for the status quo and ride this out, see how things work out. But it's unclear how they'll work out right now. But Syria is clearly believes that the trajectory is in its favor. And it's less likely to make deep concessions that might, both sides are keeping their cards very close to their chest. And so on that, I'll conclude and thank you.
Thank you, Josh. Questions in written form from the audience. There was a famous cable in the 1950s from the British ambassador to Syria reflecting on the character of the governmental hierarchy there. He said they're all mad as hatters. What do you think of the hierarchy today? Is it rational? In particular, is Bashir Assad different from his father? Are there rogue factions at work in Syria?
They're not rogue factions in Syria. The regime has consolidated since 2005. The old guard, which people used to talk about always as the reason things weren't happening in Syria, was really shoved aside. Everybody who's in any senior position in Syria today has been put there by the sun. The Bush administration really tried to put the squeeze on Syria in 2005, 2006, and it didn't destabilize the regime. it didn't force Syria to switch its foreign policy and to stop supporting Hezbollah and Hamas, breaking away from Iran, all these things that the Bush administration hoped would happen as collateral sort of advantage from the invasion of Iraq, that Iraq would turn into a pro-American place and the other people would get smart and start saluting. That didn't happen. It turns out that Bashar al-Assad is not a mad hatter. He's been pretty cagey, and he's gained a lot of respect in the region because he's outfoxed. In a sense, he's withstood the Bush years and didn't believe that things were going to work out. It's told Bush, don't do it. You're opening up in a Pandora's box in Iraq. And so in that sense, he's in charge. He's a pretty deft at playing the foreign policy in the region. The big question is whether he can reform the economy. And he has been trying to move Syria out. The biggest change has been that he has abandoned the socialist ideology of the Ba'ath Party and his father. He has said that they're going to pursue a market, social market economy, which is German wording. But they have tried to privatize. They have tried to allow private industry, now the banking industry and insurance industry and so forth have all set up shop, the fancy European designers and so forth in the bourgeois section of town. But the question is, can that trickle down be fast enough to head off a big baby boom, lots of unemployment, and a problem of economic growth? And that's the big challenge. And he's not an economist. His young wife worked for Morgan Stanley, I guess, and was an investment banker and has some savvy, but she's not in charge of the economy. So that's the question, is whether this old cranky regime that he inherited from his father and a Ba'ath Party, which he depends on in order to become president every 7 years, can change radically enough to take Syria into a new world without the regime collapsing.
What is Turkey's position on the Golan Heights?
Well, Turkey has changed a lot in the last decade. Turkey used to be a very close ally of the United States and Israel during the Cold War and member of NATO and so forth. Today, Turkey has switched. It's been rejected from the EU, from the Economic Union in Europe, and it's looking east. Today, Russia trade with Russia is about $30 billion a year. It's much more than a trade with America. Of course, there was no trade with Russia during the Cold War. Everything was pro-America. Today, Turkey took, during the Egyptian uprising, Turkey announced that it was going to move ahead with $30 billion of economic relations with Iran over the next 5 years in defiance of American demands that Turkey cut off economic relations with Iran. So Turkey has sort of gone in your face with America. And they've done that with Syria. They have supported Syria. They've dropped, Syria and Turkey have dropped all their economic tariffs. There's no visa requirement anymore. Syrians are going up north like mad. And there's this new love affair between Turkey and Syria. So Turkey is supporting Syria and is trying to build this northern alliance and a free trade zone that spans Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, which has already been announced. And so that's where Turkey is headed, because there's big bucks in it. Trade with Syria has gone from about $500 million to about $3 billion this last year, and they're hoping that it's going to get $5 billion in the next 2 years. So this is all very good for Turkey. It's trade, thick relations in the region, and that means more support for Golan.
Why is there no serious opposition to Assad? Could recent events in the region, Egypt, Tunisia, et cetera, change this?
There is not serious opposition to Assad for several reasons. One is it's a very tough regime, and the secret police, the intelligence, keep a very tight grip. They follow the opposition. They did it in other countries as well, in Egypt and Tunisia, and this is where Facebook and all these new means, I think, shocked the secret police. They didn't know how to follow these people. They were used to tapping phones and doing the old thing where they had months and years to follow these guys and put them into jail, and these were new people who were rising up. And they didn't have them in their books. They didn't know these people. They hadn't been to jail 100 times. Some of them had, but most of them hadn't. And They couldn't keep up with them. They swarmed the intelligence services and overran them. Now, that's, of course, a danger in a country like Syria. But Syria is very ethnically divided and religiously divided, unlike Egypt and Tunisia. Syria is between Iraq and Lebanon. It's got 1 million Iraqi refugees in Syria, 500,000 Palestinian refugees. One out of every 20 Syrians, more or less, 15, is a refugee. Syrians are frightened about democracy, a little bit frightened of democracy. They're frightened of what regime change gone wrong can do, because regime change gone wrong in Iraq led to terrible problems. They don't want to be Iraq. They saw Lebanon go into civil war for 15 years, very brutal religious civil war. Syrians don't want to be like that. And the regime, of course, is dominated by Alawites. There's a Sunni majority. Things could get ugly in Syria if things went wrong. So those are two of the leading reasons.
We have three questions here about the possible strategic importance of Golan to Israel. Golan Heights is strategic to farms in northern Israel. Syria used the Golan Heights to shell Israel for two decades before 1967. And the third question, what about water in the Golan? For more than 40 years, we've been told that the Israelis need to retain the water.
All these things are true. The defense argument for why Syria must maintain the Golan is an argument that has become weaker and weaker with missile technology. The Golan is no longer the big buffer because it's not loads of men streaming over the Golan that are going to. Peace is ultimately the best security. This was, of course, the argument for not giving back the Sinai to Egypt. If we give back the Sinai Peninsula, Egypt will be able to be right at our borders and overwhelm us. But peace with Egypt is the best guarantee of Israel's borders. Having good relations with Jordan and Egypt have turned out to be good. Egypt didn't immediately take the land and then stab Israel in the back or try to overwhelm it. I think the Syrians are exhausted by war. They failed to beat Israel. They understand that Israel is a superpower in the region. It's got an air force that is just overwhelms Syria. It's got a GDP that's infinitely bigger, that's bigger than all the Arab states combined that surround it. Syria needs peace. Now, of course, that takes a certain amount of trust. But that ultimately, getting to that trust and getting that peace signed is what's going to give security to Israel in the long run. Trying to take territory and beat up the neighbors is not a long-term plan. It might be a long-term plan for another 50 or 60 years, but eventually it's going to become a bad plan. And better to make a deal when Israel has the qualitative military edge than when it's beginning to lose it. It'll get a better deal. And water is important. Water is very important. In the 1990 negotiations that came close, there were tons of guarantees about water. Syria will not put its military anywhere in the Golan. It won't be able to approach the water. There will be oversight. There's intelligence stations from Israel are allowed to remain in the Golan to test and look and see if any Syrians are creeping close to it. So there are ways to police the water usage and military usage of the Golan. And Syria agreed in these negotiations not to have any army deployment in the Golan region, and to have observer early warning posts so that if anybody tried to sneak in the same way that it's in the Sinai Peninsula, it's the same way. Egyptian military doesn't deploy in the Sinai Peninsula, although it's Egyptian territory. So there are ways to overcome these sorts of security guarantees if people want to.
Are the issues of Israeli-Syrian relations separable from the Palestinian problem? Could there be an Israeli-Syrian peace?
Syrians say no. They mean yes. It's a little bit like Egypt. Egypt threw the Palestinians under the bus and the Syrians under the bus when they signed a Camp David Accord. They don't like it. Egyptians are probably the single nation that dislike Israelis the most, even though they have peace and they're willing to have peace and they're fine with peace. But secretly, they're resentful at the fact they threw the Palestinians under the bus because they feel like they're fellow Arabs and they shouldn't have done it. The Arab world is angry about Camp David and has been angry about Camp David ever since. If the Syrian government goes ahead and gets the Golan back and doesn't support and cuts supplies to Palestinians and watches the Palestinians get chewed up, Syrians will be angry. They will do it, I bet, because they want to put more food on their table and they want to grow their economy and they want to live. And they've sacrificed themselves for 50 years already for the Palestinian cause, and what has it got them? Nothing but woe. So they're ready to move on. But they won't be happy until the Palestinians get a fair share. It'll be difficult. There'll be a cold peace with Israel. The relations will not be happy. You know, eventually the Palestinians need to be taken care of because the Arab world will care about them. And even if they don't go to war against Israel, they'll care. Now maybe, you know, maybe that, I don't know. I don't ultimately know, but I think the Syrians are ready to make a deal. They'll have some language about the Palestinians, but it will be empty language. That's what would happen, like the Egyptians and the Jordanians both did before them.
A final question, Josh. Please comment on the investigation into the Hariri assassination.
Did Syria kill the Hariri? I don't know the answer to that. Strategically, there was a war going on. Lebanon had been Syria's sphere of influence for decades, ever since Syria had put troops in there to stop the Lebanese civil war in 1976. George Bush, the father, had given his okay and hands-on to that situation in 1990 when he made a deal with Syria. You get Lebanon, you support me in owning the Gulf. Syria sent troops to help throw out Iraq from Kuwait and to support the American-run coalition. At the same time, Bush the father said, you can have Lebanon. And that's the moment after that agreement was, days after that agreement was okayed, Assad moved against General Aoun, who was still holding out against Syrian domination at the time, and beat him up. That was the end of it. Lebanon was stable under Syria, stable under Syrian hegemony, until George W. Bush decided, we're going to make a new Middle East. We're going to invade Iraq, and we're going to pull Lebanon away from Syria. And so he had animated, we believe, Rafik al-Hariri, the longtime Syrian ally, to change and to try to help bring Lebanon out from this strategic position towards America and Israel and to isolate Syria. For Syria, this was going to be, very dangerous because it would mean Hezbollah would be closed down. Syria would have no more leverage for the Golan and it would be isolated. And Israel and America would, in a sense, dominate right up its whole coastline. It'll be a little bit like the Russians putting nuclear missiles into Cuba. America didn't like it and decided, now America wouldn't assassinate a president, but I was talking to a bunch of CIA guys here, so. no, I don't mean to make light of the situation. I don't know what happened. The investigation has been very inconclusive so far, and for 5 years everybody said Syria did it, and it was going to prove that Syria did it, and there was no proof that Syria was involved. Now the onus is on Hezbollah, and we believe, and the rumors have suggested, that they have evidence to indict some fairly senior Hezbollah operatives.